victims and protects public safety is to change the behavior of people who have started committing crimes. So that's the investment we're talking about. There would also be some startup costs. I know that doesn't sound like a lot of money. We've been talking about state budgets lately. It really doesn't seem like a lot of money. But as those dollars are invested, there's oversight recommendation to check what's working the best. Where is the best bang for our dollar in this system of analyzing, treating, motivating, and releasing people? And that would be an ongoing process. At the commission level, we said this can't be like a football that we're going to throw out as a Hail Mary and wish everybody good luck with these ideas that came from other states and other research. We didn't come up with anything original. We're just not that smart. But these came from other experiences, and we want to bring the best of that into Alaska.
Great answer. Did you have,
Well, Chris, you touched on education and taking it inside the facilities, and we actually do have a client right now in Lemon Creek who's working on his carpentry career diploma, so that's an exciting turn of events, and we are looking in the future to expand our program to actually go into the jail, and, education has proven to reduce recidivism, so if they're getting the training inside, coming out, getting that employment assistance, the education plus the employment piece, that's just going to be a slam dunk, so I'm glad that you mentioned the education piece, because that's the hallmark of our program. So,
and before we get off the subject of barriers, anything else you see that things that are kind of standing in the way of the commission being the commission's recommendations?
I think there's more, but I think those are the big ones. The substance abuse support, the housing, and definitely are some huge barriers.
And there's the driver's license piece too. Is that something you want to speak to? Or maybe not?
I can speak about it. I didn't spend time on the subcommittee that talked about driver's licenses, but I understand the general theory in trying to make a limited license more available to people who have lost their license because of a criminal offense. Because of the impact of losing a driver's license can have on employment, helping take care of the children, so many of the obligations that we want people who have gotten into trouble to keep, because those help with motivating them. So we don't necessarily want to break those down. And what we often find when we run into a conflict between somebody having lost their driver's license and something that they're highly motivated to do, like take the kids to school, sometimes a job, sometimes less lofty reasons, I'll admit that, but they keep getting arrested over and over and over again for driving revoked and driving suspended, and then you just keep stacking those misdemeanors on them and they start snowballing, and eventually you can dig a hole so deep that you just can't get out, and people stop even trying to drive legally. And once someone stops trying to drive legally, we no longer have a hook over their behavior. They're just going to keep going as they get caught. The other thing that we had talked about, and this has to do with the Department of Motor Vehicles revoking driver's license, even if a DWI case is dismissed or someone is found not guilty. That can happen. It does happen. I do think that the administrative revocations play a role, especially right after a DWI, that we don't want somebody driving until there's DMV maybe has a hearing as part of that process to look at it. But I can understand if someone had their case dismissed and then they're saying they want there to be a path to get their driver's license back. So I understand that it's really hard for me as a law enforcement officer to talk about that. I sound like I'm kind of choking to get that out, because I know that criminal cases get dismissed for lots and lots of reasons unrelated to the guilt or innocence of the person. Case law and the rules of the court and all of those things cut in favor of the accused person. So we do have a system that allows many, 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 many guilty people to go free rather than have one innocent person held accountable. And I understand that, but when you're working on the front lines of watching that happen, that can be very frustrating. And it's really tempting once you get somebody held accountable to just grab them and hold on to them. So it's some different theories. I've really had to try and open my mind to the criminal justice studies and the science that show what worked, because oftentimes it is counterintuitive. And this criminal justice reformation process has been difficult because we did learn so many things that became habit to us. And rethinking those is difficult, and you have to overcome your frustration over people not being held accountable to even discuss those possibilities.
Gotcha.
But the Criminal Justice Commission has formed a Title 28, a driving offenses subcommittee that's going to continue work. We're not done with our 3-year stint with this legislation. We're, I think, about a year and a half into it now. We started meeting in 2014. So we are going to move on to also address some of those things, including going through Title IV, which will be a real treat.
Which is the alcohol.
Which is all of the alcohol offenses, and has not been written or had parts coordinated with each other in a long time. So that'll be a lot of fun.
Very good. And Talia, you had something you wanted to add?
I just wanted to touch on the driver's license piece. As someone who works in client services, I have to say that it might be easier to find somebody a job with 3 pages on CourtView than somebody without a license. I mean, really, it's just a huge barrier, and I'm so glad it was mentioned. I had a client just last week that had a position with the union and lost it for no license. So, and there's a catch-22. You have to be able to pay all your fines at once. In order to do that, you have to be able to save money. In order to save money, you have to have a job. In order to have the job, you have to have the license. So you get that what comes first scenario. In any case, it's, you know, even something as simple as being able to make payments on your fines and whatnot, your reinstatement fee, would be helpful. So the license piece, it really is a big barrier.
Very good. Well, thanks for answering that question so thoroughly, everyone. If we can, I'd like to ask you what kinds of supports, we've talked about that, are helpful. And actually, I'm really curious to know what do the members of the public and policymakers need to know about community supports for returning citizens? I mean, this process is going on right now with the legislature listening to these bills that have to do with criminal justice reform. And is there anything that you think that could speak to the community or to the policymakers about the importance of all this from your perspective?
This is Don. I'll try that one. One of the assessment questions, I'm going back to the community assessment piece that the coalition is working on. One of the questions is, are there any organizational barriers that you see? And since a lot of those in that stakeholder group are in the social services, one of the answers that I kept getting back from these individuals that represented their organizations is that state funding is maybe dubious. We're not sure we can meet the mandates that we've already have. And if we do receive cuts that are trickle down, then it's likely we'll have to reduce staff. And in one organization, I know they were unwilling to hire for a new program, even though they had need, because they weren't sure that that position was going to be funded in the future. So they chose, kind of as a defensive move, not to meet a need based on kind of future perceptions of the budget issues. So really, going back to something that Chris said, there has to be community reinvestment.
And what would some of that reinvestment look like? What would you think would be some ideas for policymakers, to invest? Where are the gaps and what needs to be funded more than it's currently being funded?
I can probably answer that on a theoretical basis. Part of the plan that the community is soon to deal with is if you can begin processes while they're incarcerated, and you can begin to make those assessments, particularly for needs that can help them break some of those criminogenic cycles. For example, let's say substance abuse is one of those profound needs.
Treatment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Then once they get out, they might get some of that while incarcerated. There are some programs that DOC is Department of Corrections is using. But currently, when they get out, they're sort of on their own. The whole process for reinvestment is to make sure that they continue at some level with that support. And included in that are incentives, community support, as well as disincentives for a behavior you don't want to see. So all of that is part of this piece, and the community, as I said, is going to enter into the planning process and come March 30th to begin the process.
The Juneau community. And where are the other coalitions? I think Anchorage, Fairbanks, MATSU.
And Fairbanks, Anchorage, MATSU, you got them.
And Juneau.
Juneau,
yeah,
yes.
Each one of those communities has a reentry coalition who is working together to address issues related to reentering communities after incarceration. And Juneau has one. We mentioned that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to KTOO Radio in Juneau, Alaska. My name is Terry Tibbett, and I'm your host tonight on this show, The Focus on Community. And we're talking about criminal justice reform, and we're speaking with Don Habiger from the Juneau Reentry Coalition, Chris Sell from the Governor's Criminal Justice Commission, and Talia Ames from Second Chance Reentry Program at Central Council, Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. And we're talking about the community reentry portion that's related to the recommendations that came out of the Alaska Criminal Justice Reform, or excuse me, sorry, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And as I mentioned, Chris Sell is on that commission, and she was part of the group that was coming up with these recommendations, which are kind of filtering out through the community eventually through the coalitions, the reentry coalitions, and through programs like Second Chance Reentry Program that Talia oversees. So I was going to ask, did anyone else have anything they wanted to suggest policymakers should know or community members should know about the reentry process or things people don't usually think about in the terms of reentry?
One of the things I'd like to address is that the people, the returning citizens, they are our community. So there's a tendency, I think, to other them and say, what's happening to the community? There's so much violence, there's all these drugs, and, you know, our community this, our community that, while distancing themselves from supporting those trying to reenter productively. And, I mean, there's a lot of great energy out there right now, and I've met a lot of great people that are really invested in the reentry process. But I think the big message is, you know, it's your community. And it's made up of all of us. And, you know, the more you put into it and the more you support those returning citizens, I think the healthier our community can be.
Very good.
I think it's a matter almost of the stone that has momentum is the one that keeps moving. And right now, we've been in a tough spot with two-thirds recidivism. People look at those who have been in prison, they feel that that's going on in the community, even if they don't know that number, and they feel like you just can't trust people who are coming out of prison to do the right thing. But if we can make some reforms that start to drop the recidivism rate, we can build more of a feeling that people can come out of prison and become productive, law-abiding citizens and family members and leaders in the community. So we've got one rock that's been rolling pretty good, the recidivism one, and now we're trying to get another one, call it anti-recidivism, if you will, rolling, so that we can build some momentum in that area. And, you know, which comes first? Do you start rehabilitating first, or do you get people to support the fact that people can be rehabilitated? Well, we're going to have to do both at the same time.
Great. I was going to ask, as an example, maybe just to paint a picture for people listening, sort of a typical release situation where things are not done well. The release situation from incarceration it doesn't work out well. What are some of the factors in a scenario where it doesn't work out? And then conversely, maybe then talk about a release situation in which the supports were there and everything that was necessary for success. So maybe one that's set up for no success, and one that's set up for success. Is that a fair question?
Well, maybe we could divide and conquer, Dawn. Do you want me to take the one that was not successful? Because I've seen plenty of those.
Yes, please.
And maybe you can talk about the one that is successful. So this is Chris Sell again. And unfortunately, it happens. Sometimes people get released from prison. They have no plan. They have no place to go. They have no resources. They've burned all of their bridges, and they are high or drunk, committing a crime, burglary to domestic violence, and arrested within a day of getting out. That would be what I would consider a failure of having rehabilitated that person to any extent. So I'm sure there are more positive ones, of course.
This is Don. I have to respond on a theoretical basis. One of the things that I would remind the audience and also my colleagues is that we're still in the planning process. We as a community have to tackle this issue. We're going to tackle this issue, but we're not there yet. My understanding, and again, it's what I hear, and it's somewhat theoretical, is that currently there is a section of the population that when they're released from Lemon Creek, as an example,
Lemon Creek Correctional Center here in Juneau.
Right. They're taken to the door, and, you know, the obligation of the facility is done, the state is done, they're released, and they're on their own, and they have to figure it out. We hope to be a warm handoff, and that warm handoff is, if we have to, have somebody, maybe from the coalition, maybe a staff member in the future, that would have that warm handoff, go pick up that person, bring them to a center if we can get it that far, introduce them to a number of options that they might have for housing, for additional treatment, whether it's substance abuse, mental health care, anything like that, and get them connected and help them become successful. Change that support system from one that doesn't exist to one that does exist.
I'd say stable housing and sober support are definitely the make it or break it factors. I've seen both. We have quite a few success stories, actually, and the thing that is really prevalent in that is having the support, whether it be family or sober friends, not going back to the same environment is really hard when you don't have any other options. So when you're released and you're released into the home where you were drinking and drugging, it doesn't work. Education and employment are also key, but it's hard to hold a job when you don't have the stable housing.
Can you paint a picture of a success story that just even a theoretical one? You know, okay, so the person is released from Lemon Creek Correctional Center. They open the gate, they let them out, and tell me what it would look like, a successful reentry for that person.
It would begin with support, somebody picking them up sober and healthy, taking them to a safe, stable home where they can be supported in their recovery, which is usually a problem, a barrier there. And, you know, hopefully coming by and seeing us and working with us to find employment and training and, you know, really making a foundation of recovery. I know I'm harping on that, but I have to say it's just bottom line. It's the prevalent factor in all of our clients. I mean, it's easily 90%. So, and, you know, having supportive probation and parole officers is really great. I've worked pretty closely with Brent recently, and
Brent Wilson. He's a probation officer.
And you know, there are some great people over at probation and parole. Sometimes the clients don't think so, but as long as they're telling the line, you know, it's great support. So,
thank you for that. And I think you mentioned something about hope, Chris, and I was wondering. I think that might be something that plays into, like you had mentioned, it plays into someone's success, having hope. And how do we work that?
That's a tough one because you can lead somebody to all the right situations, but that's a really personal decision. And not being hopeful, you can live a sober life or manage your mental illness. It's something that sometimes people go through treatment multiple times and still have not come to that place that they have hope that they can manage it to the point where they can have a happy life. So what we want to do is create an environment where people can go there, that they can have positive incentives along with accountability and disincentives for poor behavior, and that they can actually make progress, because it's the thought that you can make progress, that life could be a little bit better, is the definition of hope. We don't know exactly what's going to do that for certain people, but what I've heard time and time again is that people tell me that they found hope when they got sober, when they got off the drugs and they got off the alcohol. So for people who have that addiction, they just need to find a life and support and recovery to allow them to live a hopeful life, because there's nothing less hopeful than an addict who decides to start using again. That's really giving up. So I think hope is a really complicated thing, but the hopelessness is the common denominator that we find in people that are failing and really aren't even trying anymore. So we can't have a productive, law-abiding citizen who's going to refrain from doing things that damage other people unless they have hope for themselves.
Very good. Well, thank you for all that. We have about 4 minutes left. I'm wondering if you have any closing thoughts, anything you didn't get to say, you wanted to say before we go.
I guess the reason I shared how difficult this whole process was for me for reformation is that I want people to know that it's okay to read these bills and be uncomfortable. It really is. It's okay to be anxious when you talk about shortening probation and not doing the maximum presumptive sentences in every situation and treating some people as low-risk offenders. We haven't been on that path during my lifetime that I can remember. So this is different, and it takes some time, and it takes some referencing things that have happened in other states and other studies that have happened. But there are other states to take a look at: Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, South Dakota, South Carolina, to name just a few.
Texas
is one of them.
What have they done, just for the background? What have these other states done?
Well, they've reduced their incarceration rate between 9% and 21% without having a rise in their crime rates, and they've managed to lower their recidivism rate. So they've managed to successfully kind of reform their justice programs like we are, to try and have money maybe that was spent on hard beds go to programs for people that can act, that can benefit from those, and look at multiple tools for treating people who have engaged in a criminal lifestyle rather than the more simple single tool of just locking them up. So there's a number of states you can look at. There are some references on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. There are links to so many documents you could probably read for 6 months, which is kind of what we did. But there's a lot out there. And I had other officers who read the bills and asked me, what were you thinking? And I understand that because I spent a lot of time in that place before we finished these recommendations. So, you know, I want people to understand that this is hard stuff. This is not a brass band going down the street saying we can prove this is a great idea and this is the best thing since electricity. This is working with humans who are difficult and complicated creatures and dealing with problems that are expensive to try and rehabilitate. So I just want people to understand that, that being anxious about this process doesn't mean we're doing something wrong.
Very good.
And sometimes we can assume that, but sometimes even when you're on the right path, it's uncomfortable.
Awesome. Well, I see we're almost out of time. I want to give you a chance to close and say what you want. Just to remind everybody, you're listening to KTOO FM Radio in Juneau. My name is Terry Tibbett, and I've been your host tonight for Focus on Community, and we've been speaking about criminal justice reform and reentry. And Talia from Second Chance Recovery Program, Reentry Program, wants to say something. Go ahead.
I just wanted to let people know, if you have somebody that needs the program, the Second Chance Reentry Program, we're located in the Andrew Hope Building, and our phone number is 463-7366. Again, that's 463-7366, and that's for the Second Chance Reentry Program. Thank you.
Talia, can I ask you a question that I think people might be thinking? Is this only for tribal members?
This is not. Thank you. It's for non-Native and Native folks. So.
Great. Perfect. Don, did you have any closing?
One thing I found out is our community has a number of great assets. We've been talking about gaps, barriers, but let's not forget that we have a lot of great social agencies that are already involved, and if we can support them and they can speak to the process, we'll have a great product.
And I guess you can look up the Juneau Reentry Coalition on the web, and there'll be something referencing it, I'm assuming, right?
I will have to say that we have to get that going again. We're not quite there, but we will get it going.
Okay. We'll look for it. Anything else you want to say? Okay. Well, thanks again to my guests tonight, Chris Sell, Don Habiger, and Talia Ames, and we're going to go into the next show. Thanks again, everyone.